Gleb Gregorodetsky has traveled the globe studying indigenous cultures both as a scientist and correspondent for National Geographic over the past two decades. His new book, The Archipelago of Hope, focuses on six cultures from Norway and Russia to Myanmar, Ecuador, and Canada. They are people that know better than anyone that climate change is already here and they have to deal with it on a daily basis. They are stories of tragic environmental degradation and triumphant resilience. It's all new and all blue next. Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. Gleb Gregorodetsky is the author of a new book, The Archipelago of Hope. He was raised in the then Soviet Union's Kamchatka Peninsula. His early interest in science and nature were coupled with formative experiences with native peoples and their deep connectedness to the natural world. Here's Gleb in a video clip talking about how indigenous peoples are dealing with climate change now.
Today, the rest of the world is slowly waking up to the reality of climate change. Yet most of us have no idea what it means for our lives, or the lives of our children's children. To really understand the unfolding changes, we must pay close attention to the indigenous peoples, because for them, climate change has long been not just a political slogan, a prediction, or a fundraising strategy, but a reality of their daily lives.
Well, let's meet Gleb Gregorodetsky. He joins us via Skype from his home in Edmonton in the Alberta province of Canada. When did you first get interested in science? Like, what were some formative experiences where you decided that science was something that interested you?
Well, I've read a lot when I was a kid. At that time, obviously, we didn't even have TV until I was much older. So a lot of what I had were books from the library, obviously our home library, which was quite sparse. But it was populated by the books that my dad picked up for me, and some of them included, you know, books written by Julius Verne, adventures like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and Castaways. Had a lot to do with travel. Around the world, discovering new places, observing animal behavior. And Gerald Durrell was another author that I was quite fond of reading when I was a kid. So I guess that helped me learn about the world and was formative experience how I thought about finding ways to explore the world. But a lot of it also had to do with growing up in a small village in a community where part of the people who lived there hunted and fished. And my dad was he grew up in a city, so it was all quite foreign to him, but he was really eager to discover what it was like. And for him, people who knew how to live on the land meant that they were real people, real men. And so he found a way to befriend some of them and spend quite a few weekends going on hunting and fishing trips. And when I got a little older, he started taking me along. And that's where, you know, I began my first introduction to what it's like to look after yourself when you're on the land, by hunting, fishing, looking after your equipment, your camp. But in addition to that, there are a lot of opportunities around our village to, you know, we didn't really have landscape that was very spectacular. They're just hills, tundra, and the coast. And that's where I grew up. That was my playground where I spent a lot of time with my classmates and village mates. And so I guess that's where it all started.
The book is titled The Archipelago of Hope. What exactly do you mean by that?
I guess what I mean by that is that if you look at the map of the world, There are a few places that are still very rich in wildlife, plants, animals, soil diversity, where the water is still clean and the air is fresh, and signs of Anthropocene or human impact are quite limited. And a lot of those, most of those places are on the territories that have been historically occupied by what we call indigenous people. And so those places are considered to be islands of biocultural diversity, where the relationship between people and this planet is still relatively unaltered from the ancestral ways of maintaining that relationship. And so, unfortunately, they are quite disjointed. So they're these islands of biocultural diversity spread around the world. But on those islands, that's where we can find up to 80% of biological diversity that's still known. That we've managed to document. That's where 60% of linguistic and cultural diversity resides, and that's where people still live structure their relationship with the land in a way that doesn't destroy it but sustains it. So when we think about the challenges that we are facing as humankind, I think about this place as traditional territories of indigenous people and this biocultural refugia as an archipelago of hope, because from there we can learn a lot, and our future survival depends on the persistence of those places.
Can you kind of take us on a short tour of those places, starting with North America? And let's begin there. What in British Columbia?
North America, from west coast of Canada, Vancouver Island, territory of Tlahuquiut people, who have lived in that area for millennia, according to them, from the time immemorial, and have a special relationship with that ecosystem, with the coast. And they're one of many First Nations or Indigenous tribes that have historically lived on Vancouver Island before it became, before it was quote unquote discovered or became part of Canada. Yeah, and so the ecosystem is coastal rainforest with spectacular trees, with salmon runs, with whales migrating along the coast, with seals, and abundant wildlife and rich forests that people still rely on. From there, other stories include Sapura people in Ecuador, which is part of the Ecuadorian Amazon. I guess it's along the eastern boundary of Ecuador, on the border with Peru. It's a rich rainforest, one of the most biodiverse regions of the earth, where Sapura people also have lived for millennia, hunter-gatherers who also cultivate the forest, but primarily rely on fishing and hunting and gathering. And traditionally, they used to be nomadic, moving from camp to camp during annual migration cycle. Now they're living a more settled life, but still travel throughout their territory. Then there are several stories from a couple of stories from the Arctic. One is from northern Finland, about the story of the Skolt Sami people, a small group of Eastern Sami that whose traditional territory historically been on the border between Russia and Finland. And the group that I've been privileged to work with is living in Finland, in northern Finland, in Lapland right now. And they are primarily reindeer herders and fishermen who still maintain their traditional ways of living off the land. Another Arctic group is Yamal Nenets, another group of reindeer herders in northern Russia, who have one of the longest human migrations, annual migrations on Earth, where they move their reindeer herds from winter to summer pastures and back. It takes several months to get from one end of their annual route to the other, and the distance, total distance, around 800 miles. And then along the same river system, along the Ob River system, in the headwaters of Ob River, on the border with China, Mongolia, Kazakhstan, and Russia, live Altai people, who traditionally have been herdsmen and have special relationship with a sacred landscape. All of these people have a special relationship with their territory that's very spiritual. But this particular group that I spent some time working with in Altai, they have special relationship with their sacred sites that they are trying to protect. And then I guess the last group is Karen people, who an indigenous group in northern Thailand, on the border between Thailand and Burma, who are traditionally farmers, practicing a particular kind of agriculture called Sweden agriculture that involves clearing patches of forest and for their small gardens, and then after growing crops for a couple of seasons, letting the forest return. And they've been living in that area again since time immemorial. So these six groups are the ones that I'm most privileged to work with, and who allowed me to learn from them and share their stories, and allowed me to share their stories on the pages of the book.
Let's use them as an example. What are some of the challenges that they're facing, both from climate change and also from our industrial society? Because they really are facing challenges from that.
So they're reindeer herders who have historically moved from the winter pastures to summer pastures, and their winter pastures are at the northern edge of the boreal forest, and their lush summer pastures are on the coast of the Arctic Ocean, and it takes a few months to get to the coast and then return back to the winter pastures, and it happens over a landscape that is very rich in natural gas deposits and deposits of oil, which is one of the draws for the state companies in Russia that develop these resources for the Russian government. And over 10, 15 years, the development in that region, because of the richness of those deposits, has really accelerated. And because it's taking place in the Arctic, its development in the conditions, just like in Alaska, of permafrost, where construction of roads, pipelines has to be done on the permafrost. And because of the climate change and permafrost melt, that construction is quite challenging. So the impact on the landscape from pipelines and roads is quite significant. But it also impacts ability of reindeer herders to move from the winter to summer pastures, because the footprint of gas and oil development operations on the peninsula is quite significant and is increasing. There's transportation network, there's a railroad that currently is going from the southern edge of the peninsula to the northwestern edge of it, but there are plans to expand it and cross the peninsula from west to east. And in its current configuration, that railroad is crisscrossing reindeer herding migration routes. So herders have to adjust how they travel, how they move across the landscape, and coordinate with Gazprom, which is the main developer on the peninsula, when and how they can cross across the road, the railroad, under and or over pipelines. They're still managing it, but as that development accelerates, it's becoming more and more challenging. In addition, they're losing some of their pastures to development as well, so access to lush summer pastures is quite becoming quite difficult. And that's happening at the same time as climate change is impacting their ability to travel over that landscape as well. Several years ago, for example, the unusual weather event that's called rain on snow took place in the fall. And then that basically what it is, it rains in November, December, a spell of warm weather that falls on the snow, turns into like ice crust that becomes impenetrable for reindeer trying to dig up their food. And at that particular time, it was so extensive that herders were not able to escape its impact and lost a lot of animals. And because the animals got weaker, they were not able to travel to their summer pasture. So it had this cascading effects that lasted several years. And that was one of the reasons why it took us 3 years to do the story, because we were not able to travel with the herders who had to alter their travel routes and were not reaching their coastal summer pastures.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm your host, Dave Shlom, and our guest is National Geographic field correspondent and scientist Gleb Ray Gorodetsky. His new book, published by Penguin, is The Archipelago of Hope, telling the stories of six indigenous cultures around the world dealing with the realities of climate change. Stay with us. And we're back here on Blue Dot. Let's resume our conversation with conservation biology scientist, explorer, and National Geographic correspondent Gleb Ray Gorodetsky. He joined us via Skype from his home in Alberta, Canada.
One of the takeaways I got from your book was just the resilience of all of these people that you document, and how amazingly resilient they are compared to our society that's very reliant on things. And the recent disasters really kind of put that into focus for me, where when we have a hurricane take away our power and our ability to access water and food, we really struggle, whereas these people, they know how to deal with natural disasters and difficulties. What are some of the lessons you think we can learn from them?
There are many. I would not pretend that I can articulate all of them. When we like more and more to use the word resilience just as much as we used to like to use the word sustainability, and without really being able to articulate what it means. And, you know, from the science perspective, there's this whole field of resilience science that talks about the importance of thinking about the world we live in as a relationship between social and ecological systems. So when you talk about resilience, you talk about resilience of socio-ecological systems at different scales. And so it just emphasizes that you cannot think of people as being outside of nature, that there are multiple threads that connects us, that relationship is very dynamic, and it can be resilient if different things are in place. And some of the elements that make those systems resilient are diversity. So from the perspective of indigenous communities, it's diversity in food sources, ability not only to rely on reindeer or but also to rely on fish in the situation with nenets and Skold Sami in Finland, who not only have reindeer, but Atlantic salmon is an important source of livelihood for them, as well as other sources of food that they can get from the land. It's also this idea of tied feedbacks between what people see on what's happening on the land and their ability to detect changes that they see and respond to those changes. And at the community level of indigenous communities, these feedbacks are really important, and it's part of their governance system of how they observe what's happening around them, how they interpret the science, and how they act upon them. And the shorter that feedback is, the more resilient the system is. The way our society is structured and organized is that feedback between what we observe and the decisions that we make and seeing the consequences of our decisions is just not there. So, or it's very removed. Therefore, it takes us a long time to actually react to what's going on in the world. So the people who have to live with the consequences of their decisions are a lot more embedded in the landscape and indigenous communities compared to the way our society is organized. There are also decision-making institutions in many indigenous communities that are based on long-term thinking, something that we don't have either. Our political system is not really designed in that way. So the role of elders their wisdom in decision-making and guiding decision-making process is critical in many indigenous communities. So there are those conceptual lessons that we can learn, obviously relationship that indigenous communities have with their traditional territory is very spiritual. It's a living, for them, the land and the environment is a living entity infused with spirit of their ancestors and other living beings. It's not a resource. It's not something that provides services, but it's a living being that you have to respect. That not only you have rights to access it, but you also have reciprocal responsibility that you need to fulfill in maintaining that respectful relationship. So there are some of those lessons that are important for me, and I think for all of us, when we think about how we can reconceive the way we the way we structure our relationship with the land, with the planet, with each other.
What's one big takeaway you would like to have your readers have from reading The Archipelago of Hope?
Well, the reason why it's called Archipelago of Hope is because a lot of rhetoric around climate change is largely doom and gloom. And the situation is quite dire. The future is uncertain. And that really scares people, and a lot of unwillingness to engage in that conversation is just driven by that kind of thinking. Whereas this, if you, as I have spent time in those communities, talking to them, watching them, learning from them, yes, the situation is dire, but it's by no means it is hopeless. They feel that they're quite resilient, and they have a lot of resources still to be able to adapt and move forward, but by no means they can do it on their own. So one of the key messages that I hope readers would get from the book is that we're all in it together, and the solutions that we are developing, we have to do it collectively and use the best available knowledge that's available to us, whether it comes from what we call science or indigenous wisdom. And this is an important message that indigenous people want to share with the rest of the world, and they look for respectful ways of working together in solving our contemporary problems, including climate change.
And they're very aware of, a lot of them, of what's going on with climate change and wanting to share that wisdom, aren't they?
Absolutely. And they've been aware of it for many, many years, long before we began convening international gatherings to discuss the implications of climate change. Indigenous people have been seeing signs of climate change on there, which is lands and in the air for decades, particularly in the Arctic.
Well, Gleb, best of luck to you, and thanks for joining us today on Blue Dot.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. It's been a pleasure, and I hope that readers will find the stories in the book interesting.
Thanks again to our guest, Gleb Ray Gorodetsky. You can read his article and see his amazing photographs of the Nanette reindeer herders in Russia in the October 2017 issue of National Geographic. His new book, The Archipelago of Hope, tells the story of climate change and industrial encroachment through the experiences he had with six indigenous cultures around the world. It's published by Penguin, and it comes out in November. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. Listen to this and past episodes on mynspr.org, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast. Groove on. Our communications coordinator is Casey Gardner. Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News or me at Dave Schloem. Our engineer is the man on the board, Nolan Ford. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, was composed and performed by Matt Schiltz of New York City. I'm Dave Schloem, reminding you there that from all of us here, we all live on a pale blue dot. Thank you.